DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotta Lomas. We start the show with some news. This week, European countries voted to ratify the Paris Climate Treaty, making the deal a reality. Under the Paris Pact, signed in December last year, 195 countries agreed to cut their greenhouse gas emissions in order to keep global warming to within 2 degrees Celsius of pre-industrial levels. But for the agreement to come into effect, it needed support from countries representing 55% of global emissions. Ratification by the EU bloc pushes the accord across that crucial threshold, which means the climate deal will formally enter into force on November 4th, ahead of the next round of climate talks in Morocco. At the European Parliament, United Nations Chief Ban Ki-moon urged leaders to follow through on their commitments.
I can think of no better way to secure the legacy of Paris than to have the agreement enter into force in record time, backed by the support of the world's most powerful economies and its most vulnerable countries. Rapid entry into force would demonstrate a new Europe's commitment to international cooperation. Let us work together to build this world better for all. I thank you for your leadership. Thank you very much. Merci.
US President Barack Obama welcomed the news with a special address outside the Oval Office in Washington, D.C.
Today is a historic day in the fight to protect our planet for future generations. 10 months ago in Paris, I said before the world that we needed a strong global agreement to reduce carbon pollution and to set the world on a low carbon course. The result was the Paris Agreement. Last month, the United States and China, the world's two largest economies and largest emitters, formally joined that agreement together. And today, the world has officially crossed the threshold for the Paris Agreement to take effect. Today, the world meets the moment. And if we follow through on the commitments that this Paris Agreement embodies, history may well judge it as a turning point for our planet.
The ratification of the landmark climate deal comes at a critical time. Just last week, the world's top climate scientists warned that the Earth is set to warm by more than 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. Last year was the hottest year on record, and scientists predict 2016 will be even hotter. As temperatures rise, cities are already having to adapt. Spain's capital, Madrid, is one of the hottest, driest cities in Europe. But, like all of Spain, the metropolis is just beginning to emerge from a punishing recession. So it doesn't have a lot of money to spend on high-tech climate solutions. What's it doing? Well, it's covering itself in plants. Lots of them, on walls, empty lots, and every metre of free space. From there, Lauren Freya has more.
Tourists flood the area of Madrid's so-called Museum Mile, a stretch of the Paseo del Prado, a huge 8-lane thoroughfare that's home to Spain's most renowned art museums. It's smoggy and crowded with all the traffic. Tourists often pause outside the Caixa Forum, an arts foundation.
Everyone comes here, stops, takes pictures, basically.
It's what's on the outside of this museum, rather than on the inside, that's halted American tourist Sarah Laskin and her mother, Laura. It's a giant vertical garden coating one whole outer wall of a city block.
I just think it's really cool to see all the different vegetation.
We honestly just ran into it by accident, but it's really cool.
Yes.
We didn't really know anything about it prior to coming here.
I am Isabel Fuentes, director of Caixa Forum Madrid. We are in the square just in front of the building of Caixa Forum and just in front of the vertical garden. Vertical garden?
Isabel Fuentes oversaw the installation of this vertical garden in 2008. It's essentially a huge sponge coating the building's outer wall. It absorbs and holds a small amount of water and allows plants to take root in it without soil. It's where art and nature combine, says Isabel.
It's art and it's nature, and it can see changing along the different seasons. In winter, it's sunflowers. In summer, an incredible panel of colors.
And it's something practical.
It helps to avoid noise and also help to fight with contamination, because 460 meters of plants give a considerable amount of oxygen to the air.
And it insulates a south-facing wall from heat in summer and cold in winter. Walls like this are part of Madrid's new strategy to fight climate change. There's a lot of focus on coastal cities and risk of flooding with rising sea levels. Madrid is hundreds of kilometers from the coast at nearly 700 meters above sea level. There's no risk of flooding here. But Madrid is a different kind of island, says Juan Azcarate, the climate change director for Madrid.
But we have, we can say another kind of island is the heat island. We are a city that the main risks will be related to heat and to the scarcity of water resources. So these are our main goals in terms of climate change.
In an urban heat island, dark paved surfaces absorb the sun, boosting the air temperature around them. Madrid is several degrees warmer than the surrounding countryside. In a municipal office building that's being renovated to install heat-deflecting windows, Juan and his team pore over climate change data. Scientists estimate that by the year 2050, Madrid will have 20% more unusually hot days, and it'll rain 20% less. So they've allocated millions of euros in public funds to prepare for that. By expanding existing parks, painting roofs white instead of black to reflect the sun, converting vacant lots into green space, and building roof gardens and walls.
Big green areas have an effect of cooling the city at nights, and also can an added value of capturing carbon.
Greenery also shades the pavement and releases water vapor into the air. Summer temperatures have already been measured at 4 degrees lower in pilot neighborhoods where the first of these gardens have been installed. To water them, the city is repaving plazas with porous material that captures rainwater. There are also tax breaks for companies that coat their roofs or facades with greenery. This is all part of a larger environmental strategy that started with burying a major city highway in 2003, routing it through a tunnel underground and then planting trees above. It's since become one of the city's most popular parks. Madrid has spent tens of millions of euros on improving public transit, restricting cars from narrow central streets, and creating the world's first municipal electric bike scheme. At Puerta del Alcalá, one of Madrid's biggest and busiest traffic circles, I meet Susana Saif, an architect and environmental expert.
Well, I'm Susana Saif. I'm an architect, have a PhD in urban microclimates and the way in which vegetation affects urban climate.
Susana did her PhD on how roof gardens can lower the air temperature. She now works for Arup, one of a growing number of environmental design and sustainability companies that help cities like Madrid prepare for the climate future.
Should we sit maybe in the shade a bit, and we can, maybe there's a bench or...
Yeah, but it's also, there are
yeah.
Over there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's noisier.
Ah, because we're closer to the...
Yeah, we can just
so we
go
inside
the main
up here,
part,
yeah.
Together, we walk into Madrid's Retiro Park, a green oasis in the busy city center, and she explains how our short walk from traffic into greenery is exactly the transformation she seeks to create in her work, designing gardens and sustainable buildings.
As you can feel, we just came from the noisy street. Now we are just surrounded by trees.
It also feels colder.
Yeah, colder. You really can feel the heat island is reduced. The climate is nicer, so it's a way in which we can help to adapt our cities against the problems that we are having with climate change. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It's what Susana calls a green envelope to combat the heat island. Her firm's research shows that if 20 to 25% of city buildings were to coat their roofs or facades in greenery, it could reduce urban noise by up to 10 decibels. reduce temperatures by up to 10 degrees Celsius, and reduce particle pollution by up to 20%.
You could see quantitatively the impact of these solutions on air pollution, on mitigation of heat island, on water storage, stormwater management. So it's really quantifiable.
Even in a few years, you can measure.
As we finish our interview, Susanna and I exit the park and head back into a concrete jungle of traffic, heat, and noise. A reminder of what Madrid is up against as it battles the effects of climate change. Lauren Freyer, DW, Madrid.
Madrid isn't the only place grappling with rising temperatures. The changing climate is also testing wine-growing regions in France. It's harvest season there at the moment, and experts say bad weather could shrink production by more than 10%. But this year may still deliver some good wines. While it's too early to pin the volatile weather on climate change, scientists say that's the kind of scenario wine growers will face in the future, forcing the industry to fundamentally rethink its growing practices and reshaping the very identity of famous regions like Bordeaux. From the French island of Corsica, Lisa Bryant takes a look at what's at stake.
The sun is beating down on workers harvesting grapes at Domaine Maestrachi, a small vineyard in Corsica's northwestern Valagne area. The surrounding valley is ringed with hills and picturesque villages, a snapshot of what this place looked like a century ago. But today, a tractor is harvesting grapes mechanically, trailed by workers from Romania and Morocco who pick up the leftovers.
So here you have some barrels of 500 liters.
That's not the only thing that's changed.
So we were waiting for the rain, and yesterday and the day before yesterday it was raining, and now I think that it will be good enough.
Camille Anaïs Roust manages Domaine Maestrachi, which has been in her family for five generations. Dry, hot weather has pushed up the harvesting date for Corsican wine.
All Corsican vineyards are harvesting at the same time. Normally we have 15 days, 21 days of gap between the first that begins the harvest and the latest. I think that wine won't be enough balanced, you know. It may be lack of something to have something that can last in the time.
Valagne is not the only wine-growing region affected by a changing Mother Nature. Storms and frosts earlier this year have reduced harvest from Champagne to the southern Languedoc region, which was also hit by drought. Experts say climate change may intensify this volatile pattern, although in recent years, hotter weather has also produced some fantastic vintages. Jean-Marc Touzard is Research Director for Innovation at the French National Institute for Agricultural Research, or INRA. He's working with other scientists to see how France's wine industry can adapt to climate change.
Under 2 degrees of temperature growth, we'll know that there will be solutions for all vineyards in France. But if really we will have 3 or 4 degrees of growth, some region will have strong difficulties to keep on producing wines, good wines.
At Domaine Maestrachi, Rao's partner, Roger Chouat, runs a machine that separates the grapes from their stems. He says Corsica's dry spell hasn't just affected wine growing.
There's a lot of demand for water, especially for growing cereals like corn. Even for potable water, the dams are getting lower and lower.
Researchers say changing weather will also affect how wine will taste. Like elsewhere in France, wine growers in Corsica are experimenting with new grape varieties, partly because of climate change.
Après, vous avez de la cuverie pour les rosés, les blancs. Là, vous avez toute la réception à vendange avec le pressoir.
Winemaker Bernard Renucci is trying out local grapes Corsican wine growers abandoned long ago. One, Bianco Gentile, is harvested early and produces a rich white wine.
C'est pour voir, l'évolution de la fermentation, pour la contrôler, pour voir si elle descend.
Rinucci shows visitors around his cellar where newly harvested grapes are now fermenting in big metal tanks. The vineyard makes red, white, and rosé wines in the village of Felicetu, where Rinucci was born and raised. A century ago, this cellar was once a barn, where the Rinucci family kept pigs and cattle. Like the nearby Maestracci vineyard, he's facing earlier harvests than in the past.
Non, moi je me souviens quand je faisais les vendanges avec mon père, quand j'étais petit.
I remember harvesting with my father when I was about 8 years old. We never harvested grapes in August. It was always at the end of September. For the moment, I don't think there's a problem. If there are extreme conditions, maybe. But what's important is to find the right maturity.
Other French wine growers also believe they can adapt to climate change. Jean-Jacques Jarjanet heads France's Independent Wine Growers Union, representing about 7,000 members.
Nous aujourd'hui, ce que l'on constate, c'est que, et ce que l'on attend, c'est pas pour la vigne, effectivement.
We are not expecting a catastrophe. What we see happening is completely manageable. Obviously, there will be some vineyards more vulnerable than others. But generally today, at the moment, there isn't a big worry.
As for climate change affecting the flavor of French wines, well, wine history is all about changing tastes.
Alors, les vins que nous buvons aujourd'hui n'ont rien à voir avec ceux qui pouvaient se boire il y a 40 ans.
The wine we drink today has nothing to do with the wine we drank 40 years ago, and it won't be anything like what we drink 40 years from now.
Still, Jarjanet is betting on a 2 degrees centigrade warming over the century. Many scientists believe the increase will be higher. Research director Touzard believes adapting to climate change will mean shifting the location of vineyards and winemaking practices and growing different grapes. That would change the very identity of wines like those from Bordeaux that are based on a short list of permitted grapes. It also means revising France's Appellation d'origine contrôlée, ancient growing rules specific to each wine region.
We also will have to change some rules, for instance, code of practices for each wine, geographical indication, will change.
All of this will change the very foundations of the French wine industry.
Up. Up. Good acidity.
At Maestracci Vineyard, Roust is already preparing for a drier future. Some fellow winemakers who irrigate their vines are worried.
They think that we will be out of water. I'm not sure, because in Corsica we have a lot of water under the soil.
Roust practices biodynamic viticulture, a form of organic farming that uses very little irrigation and takes into account things like lunar cycles.
When you irrigate, vines are more sensitive to the dryness. I prefer letting them suffering a little, and I let them suffer. They will go down and search for water.
Ralph's white wine was poured out on a recent evening here. The assessment: delicious. Lisa Bryant, DW, Felicetu, Corsica.
Il est parfumé. Il est rond. Il est rond. Rond et parfumé.
From the taste of climate change to the sound of it.
Hey everybody, this is Bubba Brinkman recording live from New York City.
Bubba Brinkman is a Canadian rapper who writes lit hop or literature hip hop. A self-described nerdy rapper, he sings about bookish topics from evolution and medicine to climate change. I spoke with Bubba Brinkman on the line in New York about his latest album called A Rap Guide to Climate Chaos. I started off by asking him who his music is targeting.
I'm trying to cast the net as wide as I can in terms of my audience. I'd like to reach some people that don't think climate change is a problem and make them realize that it is and it needs to be addressed. And actually, I did this show off Broadway in New York for 5 months earlier this year and perform for thousands of people who came to see it. And, you know, I did have people come up to me afterwards and say, I'm convinced. I came to this show thinking there was no problem, and now I realize there's a big problem. So that's definitely a big part of my audience. But then I think a lot of people come to the show or hear, you know, turn on the album, assuming that they're on board, and they're like, yeah, climate change is a problem and I'm dealing with it because I take shorter showers and I ride my bike to work and I change my light bulbs so that they're not incandescent. And you know, part of the message of the album, which is counterintuitive to a lot of people, let's say on the left, who think they're already on board with the solution, is that that's not good enough. That's not even going to come close to solving the problem. And the only way that it can be solved is via sort of mass scale interventions like carbon taxes or cap and trade systems that change the entire economic incentive structure. So I'm advocating for people to be citizens more so than just consumers. Your mama's carbon footprint is so fat. That's a song called Battle Lines, and it's kind of like making fun of some of the contentiousness around this. And how it's like really combative in the public discourse. So I relate that to like battle rap comparisons, you know, like the mismatches on either side are shocking. It's like Sarah Palin against Stephen Hawking, because I think the level of intellectual discourse can be pretty mismatched. Your mama's carbon footprint is so fat. How fat is it? It's fatter than a herd of cattle's methane emissions. It's so fat it shows up on NASA's instruments. Your mama's carbon footprint is so fat when it happens, it melts whole glaciers and floods Manhattan. I'm kicking battle raps on climatic facts with consequences for human habitats like Drake and Meek Mill or Jay-Z and Nas, like a high-stakes version of Lil' Kim. I've kind of created this formula over the years, so each of my records, the Rap Guide albums, is peer-reviewed by experts in the field. So as I'm devising the lyrics, I'm reaching out to scientists and the people who really study this stuff firsthand, and I'm saying, can you look at my lyrics? Can you tell me if there's anything that misconstrues the science? And if there's problems, I'll change it. So I'm soliciting feedback.
Why do you think music's such an effective medium to talk about such big issues like climate change?
Well, I feel like there's a memorability factor. Like, music is designed to be catchy and to get stuck in your head and get you singing along. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of lyrical witticism in there and punchlines and metaphors and, you know, just ways of thinking about climate change that we would be counterintuitive but are designed to be memorable. So I think, you know, that's just not my music. That's what all music is like. And I think rap music specifically is a storytelling medium, and stories are more memorable than just concepts. So I feel like the tools were already there. It's just that a lot of rap music is telling certain stories, like the stories of the individual rappers, like here's my neighborhood and here's where I come from and here's my aspirations and that kind of stuff. But a lot of it's very sort of strictly autobiographical. And, you know, I do some of that in the album as well and talk about my background and how that makes me interested in climate change. But then also the question of how do you get to be a suburban white middle-class Canadian that's a hip-hop artist rapping about science for the masses. That's kind of like part of my story. And I do make it personal in that kind of way. But I think just music is a medium for connecting with people, I guess, emotionally in a way that maybe a lecture can't do. But this rhythm and the music is my living. When I do it, I get paid. Yeah, it's been a decade since I've had a day job, and I did it my way, like Frank Sinatra. I'm just kicking up a racket. I could be at a university teaching classes, but this is more fun than teaching. Look at the people I'm reaching. Been around the world. I fly to Europe for the weekend, do a gig in California before I fly to New Zealand. I've got a song called Fossil Fuel Ballers, which is basically about, you know, in hip-hop there's this trope of like a baller is somebody that sort of ostentatiously flaunts their wealth, and in the context of recent human history, Western civilization could be said to to be ballin', to be sort of stuntin', and like Western civilization is a bling-heavy phenomenon, let's say. And fossil fuel is kind of really the driver of that. You know, it drives most of the economic growth, and global stock markets are still hugely tied to the oil price and things like that. So, you know, I'm an example of a fossil fuel baller, but I think so are you, and so are most of your listeners going to be if their financial stability comes from the benefits of burning fossil fuels, which I think is the case with most people, because 80% of the global economy is driven by fossil fuels right now. And as for carbon emissions, I'm off the charts with it. Fossil fuel is how I got here, both to entertain you and in my career. If you're earning something, well then you're burning something. Prosperity is driven by internal combustion.
Where are you drawing inspiration from?
Well, I think it's mostly hip-hop. My musical influences are mostly rappers. And all throughout the album, I'm referencing a lot of my favorite rappers. You'll hear scratches and cuts from Jay-Z and Eminem and MC Light. And there's references to KRS-One and Nas. And, you know, my musical influences tend to be a little bit old school, like 90s and 2000s and not so much to the rappers that are big today, but that's just, you know, I'm in my 30s. That's like the rap that I grew up on.
And what about Mo Carbon, Mo Problems?
Well, that is a paraphrase of a Notorious B.I.G. song called Mo Money, Mo Problems, which was a big hit in the 90s. And, you know, in that chorus, he said, the more money we talk about, the more problems we see. And really, carbon is a driver of climate change. It's the main driver of climate change because both methane and CFCs and CO2, those are all sort of carbon-based greenhouse gases. And so carbon in the atmosphere is the summary problem that we have to overcome. And the more of it we have in the atmosphere, the more problems we end up with on Earth.
One song out of your entire album, which is your favorite and why?
Well, I think I would have to say the song Carbon Bubble, because Carbon Bubble is fun, bouncy. It's actually really a dance song. It's got a bit of like a Lily Allen or Amy Winehouse kind of flavor to it. I got an amazing soul singer named Mariella based here in New York to do the hook. And it's actually all about carbon finance models. You know, it's a sort of very nerdy, like policy wonk analysis of cap and trade versus carbon taxes versus business as usual from a financial perspective. But it's actually super fun, bouncy dance song, and it's got some great like saxophone and horn lines in it, and it's about as much like musical whimsy as you could imagine mixing with as much policy complexity in the form of one song, and that's really what I'm all about. I'm a businessman. I need a carbon price to handle my business. Damn.
What do you want your listeners to take away from your music?
Well, I don't know if I want them to be entirely persuaded and indoctrinated by everything I say, but I hope I give them a sense of curiosity and have provoked them to go look this up more and take more of an active interest. You know, I think if I can snap people out of apathy and make them feel like, yes, this matters, and yes, I need to get informed on it, then that'll be enough. To reduce emissions, get paid, which is
great, unless it's only big business capped in charge. That was Barbara Brinkman talking about his new album, A Rap Guide to Climate Chaos. For more on Barbara, visit his website at barbarabrinkman.com. If you'd like to listen to more from Living Planet, just download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes or simply visit our website at dw.com/environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Thanks for tuning in.